You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of John Shorey, and we're going to be talking about his book on the window of the Lord's return. And of course, subtitled 2012 to 2020. Now, it's really a book about the rapture. And of course, why should we be really worried about the rapture? Why should we really be concerned about whether the pre-trib position or the mid-trib position or the certainly post-trib position are right? Well, the question is the Bible relevant to what's going on in the world today? And that's a question most people don't really ask. In fact, is God really relevant? Certainly, we live in a material world, and we see all these things happening, and some of them are rather hard to interpret. I mean, how do we make any sense of so much of what's going on over in the Near East and the Middle East, and America supposedly in favor of democracy, and yet we find out now they've been lying to us, they've actually been financing the revolutions over there, and we're installing new dictatorships under the control of the Muslim Brotherhood, and why would we do something like that? It just doesn't make sense. Well, with us this evening, of course, is John Shorey, and we're going to be talking about his view on the timing of the rapture. Why is that significant? Well, because so many Christians honestly believe in a pre-tribulation rapture. It's almost as if that has something to do with the very foundations of Christianity, because it's taught in so many of the churches today. But is that position accurate? And certainly, is basically an awful lot of Christians involved. Their church, but they're not concerned about politics because they think that nothing bad will ever happen to American Christians. Well, John, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Stan, for bringing me on.
Well, I want you to tell our listeners about your study, how it was that you came to write your book on the window of the Lord's return.
Well, I wasn't looking to write a book. And about 7 years ago, when my wife and I were on part-time staff at a church as children's pastors, we had a visiting evangelist one day, and what happened is that on that Sunday night, I kind of snuck off so I could get in on the last few minutes of his message. And when he got done preaching, he called people up for prayer, and then he asked people to come up and help pray. So I went up to help pray, and he didn't know who I was, but he came forward amongst those that were up at the altar. He pointed me out. First thing he did, he says, you over there, I have a word from the Lord for you. And he told me a number of things, but the thing that really caught my attention was, he says, the greatest years of your ministry are ahead of you. Well, a number of the things that he said over the next 2 years, they were all happening. So I went to the Lord in prayer, and I said, Lord, you have been blessing me, but what am I supposed to do that will lead me to the greatest years of my ministry? And with fasting and prayer, all I could hear in my heart was I was to do a study on the end times. I was to self-publish it and give it to pastors and leaders. And this is how it all started.
And basically, of course, you started out believing in the pre-trib rapture, didn't you?
That's right. I had always been taught pre-trib, and that's where my leanings were. I had a few doubts, but when I went to start writing this book, I figured, well, God was going to answer the questions and put it to bed, and I would know that the rapture was pre-trib, but that's not what the result was.
And of course, the thing is, of course, the pre-trib rapture gets you thinking, well, I don't have to worry about anything because I'm going to be raptured out of here before anything bad happens. But tell that to the people over in Syria today, or the Christians in Egypt, or the Christians in Afghanistan, or the Christians, well, there aren't any Christians in Afghanistan. They've all been forced to leave.
Yeah, that's right. You know, what I'd like to actually tell your audience is that I realize that this subject is really sensitive to many people, I've discovered. And a lot of people do not want to receive this. But I just want to encourage people to study this thoroughly. And what I would like to let your audience know is that I am willing to answer any questions that you may have, and your audience can actually contact me through my book website called tribulationtruth.com, okay? But as you were saying, you know, people around the world have been suffering, going through tribulation. One of the things I point out to people is that God's chosen people, the Jews, went through the Holocaust. So why do we in America think that we are so privileged that we would never go through tribulation?
Well, I think that maybe we really need to reevaluate what we believe, because this is really a more modern, I believe it's only been around at most a couple of hundred years. And basically, this idea that we're all going to be whisked away before anything bad happens. And I think we really need to begin looking at what the scriptures really say. And that is, I think, the beauty of your book. I enjoyed your book thoroughly. The Window of the Lord's Return. So go right ahead, John.
What would you like me to address right now?
Well, why don't you just start out at basically, why would you question what we've been told? And then, of course, I think one of the most important verses is 2 Thessalonians 2, because of this, my wife had pointed this out a long time ago, and there's no way, of course, that we could have a pre-tribulation rapture if 2 Thessalonians 2 is accurate.
Well, you know, when I started this study, that was the one verse that showed a couple of events that have to happen before the rapture that really kind of, you know, gave me questions. And this was really something I wanted to have the answer to. Because in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 1 through 3, it says, concerning the coming of our Lord, Jesus Christ, and our being gathered to him. That gathering to him is talking about the rapture. In fact, further on down the verse, he talks about, you know, the thought that people were saying that the day of the Lord had already come. And this day of the Lord always refers to the rapture. And Paul said, don't let anyone deceive you, for this event shall not happen until there be a falling away and the man of sin be revealed. The Antichrist has to be revealed before the rapture. Well, you know,
Hold that thought, John. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly John is just pointing out that 2 Thessalonians 1, 2, 3, basically, in essence, says that the man of sin is not going to become apparent until, the Lord is not going to come for his people until the man of sin has been revealed. In other words, still the Antichrist is here. Well, basically, of course, that means the Antichrist has to come before the rapture. And there's no way you could change the reading of 2 Thessalonians 1, 2, 3. But you pick the story up there, John.
Yes. Well, you know, pre-trib teaching, one of the main parts of pre-trib teaching is that the rapture is imminent, that nothing else has to happen. But if you understand that the Antichrist has to arise first, then when you start reading the study that I have done and see the things the Lord has shown me, you realize that there are some major events that have to happen before the rapture can happen. Because when I was studying for this book and studying in Revelation, the Lord showed me something about the coming Antichrist that we had all missed. But as I've shared this with pastors, teachers, and everybody, they recognize that what the Lord showed me is true. In Revelation 13, it says, one of the heads of the beast is fatally wounded. Well, that verse has been interpreted that the head of the one world government would be fatally wounded and he would come back as the Antichrist. Well, if you study that verse, what you realize is that the word beast, one of the heads of the beast, is referring to a one world government with 10 heads, 10 crowns, 10 horns. Well, what people realize now is, you know, the Bible says that every people, language, and nation will be under the rule of the Antichrist. Every nation, even America. And what is happening is the people that are looking at forming a one-world government are looking at global, everybody. And they've divided the world into 10 regions, with each region having a head of state. So that one-world government with 10 heads, when it says, one of the heads of the beast is fatally wounded, what it's referring to is one of the heads of state. It doesn't mean wounded in the head. It means that one of the 10 leaders of 10 regions will be fatally wounded. And you know what this means? This means that in order to be qualified to be the Antichrist, you have to be one of those 10 heads of state, which really makes things very interesting, because that even means the president, the leader of the North American region, qualifies to be the Antichrist.
And I think it's important people understand that basically the North American Union is one of the 10 major blocks in the world. The European Union is another one of the blocks, and then there's certainly a block in South America and in Africa. And basically, of course, certainly John goes through all of these blocks, these 10 blocks of nations, which are accepted now as the basic building blocks for this one world government. And those of you who listen to our program know we often talk about the fact that the ultimate goal of all the secret societies we deal with is this one world government. But people don't understand the spiritual implications of this. And basically, if the Bible is relevant, and I believe it is, I think the Bible is telling us exactly what's going to happen, and that this is all about the world government, and of course that this is coming down the line. And of course, John brings out so many significant things, and one of them is there's going to be a great financial collapse. And you, well, but you go ahead, John, but so much of what John says, as he analyzes this from his point of view and certainly analyzing the scriptures, corresponds to exactly the things that I've come up with from studying what the conspiracy is doing and reading what these various organizations are actually about today. So pick up the story, John.
Sure. Well, based on what I just said, when you realize that the 10 heads have to be in place before one of them can be fatally wounded, then what you realize is that the one world government has to be in place before the Antichrist can be revealed. And if the rapture can't happen until after the Antichrist is revealed, well, then what that means is that the rapture can't even happen until after the one world government is formed. Now, this really opens up some interesting thoughts, because what will it take for the nations of the world to give up their sovereignty and willingly join a one-world government? What will it take for America to cancel its constitution and willingly join a one-world government?
And it's going to have to be there's some sort of a major financial catastrophe or some sort of a major conflict. Would you think those were two very good possibilities?
Yeah, I think that something huge is going to ultimately trigger economic collapse, financial collapse that will be global. It could start in Europe and ripple to America. It could start in America and ripple to Europe. It could be started by a war. It could be started by a terrorist event. But the point is, when this economic collapse hits, and it literally causes the collapse of currency, credit cards lose their value, money loses its value, you would end up having a complete collapse of infrastructure. We would see famine, martial law, starvation. These things will cause nations to say, if there's a global solution, I'm for it. And when we go through that period of time, I'll tell you, in America, life as we know it will be over. We need to be prepared and realize that this is coming.
I agree with you, and we keep stressing the importance of making your personal preparations, but also your spiritual preparations, because terrible times come. I mean, here we're reading in the paper, you know, just today, that North Korea is threatening to bomb New York. I mean, what sort of madness is that? And yet, of course, the Iranians have already said that if they're attacked, they will certainly respond by attacking the United States. And we know the Iranians are actually practicing over there in some of the inland seas over in Asia. They're actually practicing an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse attack on America. We have no defense against it. Is that what's going to happen? We don't know, but some major event is going to be taking place. Incidentally, of course, North Korea recently said that they were going to attack not only New York and Los Angeles, Austin, Texas. Why would they want to attack Austin, Texas? But we live in a world gone mad, ladies and gentlemen. And yet, of course, behind everything going on, I believe there are powerful spiritual forces. And if you believe the Bible is relevant, and I believe the Bible is very relevant, and why, of course, I think this is why John's book is so vitally important, why we're carrying the book, and we'll tell you later on how to get it. But I started reading the book, and I had a hard time putting it down. And many of the points that John has made, certainly are the points that I've come up with, certainly from my studies, from an entirely different point of view. But he's come up with these ideas based upon his extensive study of the scriptures. Go right ahead, John.
Well, you know, the title of my book, The Window of the Lord's Return, 2012 and 2020, basically, the title of this book came from a study from Matthew where it talks about the budding of the fig tree. And I did a study in the Old Testament on the fig tree, and the fig tree literally referred to the land that belonged to God. And in Joel, it talks about the prophecy that the fig tree would die. And in fact, it goes on into other verses of the Bible, which I cover in this study, where it shows that the children of Israel, because of the evil things they had done, that they would be dispersed to all parts of the world. And it says that the fig tree would be barked, which would kill the fig tree. Well, then in Matthew, it said that the fig tree would bud. And the budding of the fig tree means that the land that was dead, Israel, was not a nation for 2,000 years. But in 1948, the fig tree, the land that belonged to God, came back to life. And this was a miracle. So this is the basis of the window, because I show in Scripture that a generation, because Matthew says, one of these events was the rebirth of Israel through the fig tree. And it says, this generation shall not pass away till the coming of the Son of Man. I show why that a generation is 70 years, possibly a little longer, but 70 years from 1948 to 2018. And I show in a chapter called The Window of the Lord's Return, all of these events that are prophetic in nature that are all falling in this window. And I believe that we are in the time. Now is the time. The Lord is coming soon.
Well, I think he is. I don't know when it's going to be. I think a lot of things are going to happen, but I think we're going to see dramatic changes in the coming years. And how soon it'll be, no one knows. We're told in the scriptures, no one knows when the Lord's coming. But of course, it is John's contention that the rapture is not going to come before the tribulation. There's going to be a great deal of suffering for Americans, and the rapture will be mid-trib. In other words, after 3.5 years. But you pick up the story, John.
Well, excuse me, I kind of lost my train of thought. But the window of the Lord's return in 2012 to 2020, if you take a look at Matthew, where it talks about Matthew 24, where it, in fact, Matthew 24 is literally an outline of Revelation chapter 6, where it goes through the seals, the six seals. And at the end of Matthew 24, it talks about the sun going black and the moon not giving its light. And then it says, at that time, the sign of the Son of Man will be seen coming in the clouds. If you look at Revelation chapter 6, the opening of the seal, the sixth seal is the same as what is talked about in Matthew.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Go right ahead, John.
So in Revelation 6, the sixth seal is where it says the sun will go dark and the moon will not give its light. And in my study, if you will look at, you know, the read my book, you will see that I show the rapture is in Revelation chapter 6, 7, and 8. Okay, at the end of the sixth seal, that coincides with the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all of them actually saying that when the sun goes dark and the moon does not give its light, at that time the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the clouds. Well, if you go and read Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, one of the elders is commenting, and what happens is a multitude in white robes appear at the throne of God, and this elder says, who are these who cannot even be numbered in white robes who have just appeared? And he's told, well, you know who they are, and then he says, yes, these are those who have come out of the great tribulation. Well, you know, that's the rapture. And if you read Revelation chapter 8, verse 1, the opening of the seventh seal, it says, the seventh seal was opened and there was silence in heaven for 30 minutes. I believe this silence is going to be what will happen when we arrive at the throne of God. It will be so awesome, we will be speechless. All the hosts of heaven will be seeing God's redemption unfolding before their eyes, and everyone will be speechless until our Heavenly Father welcomes the bride of His Son into our new home.
All right, fine. Well, basically, of course, I really enjoyed your analysis of the, you know, the opening of the various seals, the first seal. Why don't you go through the seals? Because I think that really helps people to understand what you're saying. The first seal, the second seal, the third seal, the fourth seal, the fifth, and then the sixth seal, and why the sixth seal is so important.
Well, you know, what is really important is that when you go through these seals, that you study Matthew 24. And, of course, I outline all of this in my book. But in chapter 6 of Revelation, it talks about the first seal is the one on the white horse, and he has a bow and no arrows. Well, I believe that the first seal is the revealing of Antichrist. Now, you know, I've had many people try to tell me that, well, the seals is the wrath of God, and we're not supposed to go through the wrath of God. Well, you know, I was really struggling with this because I don't believe that the church will go through the wrath of God. And I believe the wrath of God starts after our arrival in heaven. In fact, if you read Revelation chapter 8, verse 1, where it says there's silence in heaven for 30 minutes, following that silence where we have arrived at the throne, it says the seven angels are given the seven trumpets, which they blow, signifying the seven trumpets of God's wrath. Well, if you go through the seals, and like I say, I've had a pastor told me one time, he says, well, the seals is part of the wrath of God. And I questioned him. I said, the fifth seal is the martyrdom of the saints. God is not going to martyr his saints. And then he came back and he told me, he said, well, the first four horses, which are the first four seals, those are the wrath of God. And I thought to myself, well, revealing of Antichrist, that don't sound like the wrath of God. The second seal is that there would be a
war. Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and John is certainly going through these the seals. And basically, you need to get your Bible out and go through Revelation 6. And basically, as he analyzed it, I learned a great deal. And as he points out, the first seal is the rider on the, open it, and there's the rider on the white horse. And of course, John feels that is the Antichrist. And then, of course, the second seal is that the rider on the red horse, and there's this terrible war and terrible bloodshed and suffering. And then the third seal is the rider on the black horse, and that's the famine that's coming to the world. And then the fourth seal The fourth seal, of course, is the and here's what one of the things I really weren't. I always thought that that was going to lead to the death of a quarter of the people in the world. But of course, this is the death of this one quarter of the world is going to come under this this terrible suffering and death and plagues. And then, of course, then you get to the the fifth seal and the sixth seal, and basically John feels that the church is taken out at the between the sixth and seventh seal. But John, you pick this up because you've done a wonderful study on it. You put a lot of thought into it, and I think your explanation will help our listeners understand what this is. And as John points out, you have to actually read Matthew 24 and in conjunction with Revelation 6. You need to study the two together. Go right ahead.
Well, you know, as I was saying, you know, going through these seals, which you've just basically outlined, I had a struggle. You know, I just don't see the seals as the wrath of God. So I actually went to the Lord in prayer, and I said, Lord, would you let me know what's the difference between the seals and the wrath of God? And as I was praying, it was like the Holy Spirit just dropped the answer. And the Holy Spirit spoke to me and says, the difference is the delivery. The wrath of God is delivered by angels, and there are no angels in the seals. Well, I didn't know this. I went to my Bible, and I read through all six seals leading up to the rapture. There was not an angel to be mentioned. When you read through the seven trumpets of God's wrath, every one of those trumpets is blown, and the wrath is delivered by angels. When you go and you read the seven vials or the seven bowls of God's wrath, every one of them is delivered by angels. When you go and do a study in the Old Testament, you realize that angels were involved in God's wrath. I mean, I could not even find an exception to it. You know, the angels delivered the wrath of God in Egypt. When David did a census that displeased God, it was an angel that delivered the wrath of God. There are no angels in the seal.
Go right ahead.
Okay, well, you know, when you get to Revelations, at the end of Revelation 6, it's really interesting. Because what it says, I watched and he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair, and the whole moon turned blood red, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as late figs. Then it says, then the kings of the earth, the princes, generals, the rich and mighty, and every slave and every free man hid in caves. They called to the mountain and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come. Well, you know, this verse is showing a time where those who are not Christians are scared to death. They're running to find themselves a hole in the rocks to hide them from the wrath of God.
Now, what verse in Revelation is that?
This was the last verse. This would be Revelation 6. 13.
Okay, Revelation 6:13. Go right ahead.
And actually 15. It says, the kings of the earth, the princes and generals, the rich and the mighty, and every slave and every free man, hid in caves. They call to the mountains, fall on us. It says, in one verse it says, it's a great and terrible day. Well, you know, this is when that sun goes black and the moon does not give its light. It is going to be a great day for the saints, because in Matthew and Mark and Luke, all three of them say when the sun goes dark and the moon does not give its light, at that time, one version says, then we will see the sign of the Son of Man coming in the clouds. So we are going to be rejoicing, but it will be a terrible day when the wrath of God is at that point, when we are evacuated off the earth, then those who have not accepted Christ will be looking for a place to hide.
And I think the other point that John makes is suddenly that they're in heaven, you know, and the angels see all of these people in white robes, and they're saying, where do those people come from? Well, of course, it is John's contention that the angels are seeing the Christians who've been taken to heaven in the rapture. Is that a correct interpretation, John?
Yes. Well, you know, In Revelations 4:1, most people, you know, that hold to a pre-trib rapture believe that the rapture happens in Revelations 4:1.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment.
While a storm cloud gathers far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer.
All right, John, go right ahead. You were just saying that many Christians think that the rapture takes place in the fourth chapter of Revelation. I don't, but many people do.
Yes.
That is a pre-tribulation belief. Go right ahead.
Yes. Well, you know, I cover this extensively in my book, and I'll try to touch on a couple of the important points. John is told to come up here and to come literally to the throne of God. And he says, and I will show you things to come. Well, you know, I believe this was a personal translation, had nothing to do with the rapture. It was literally God bringing John to heaven to give him the revelations of the book of Revelation. Well, what's interesting is we have taken this to be symbolic of the rapture of the church. But you know what? If you study the rapture, we are always caught up to the clouds. And Daniel lays out how the Son of Man, when we meet him in the clouds, leads us to the throne. Well, John, he is asked to come up here. You know, when it's time for the rapture, God's not going to ask us to come up here. It's going to just happen in the blink of an eye. We're not going to be asked to come up. We're going to be caught up. And nowhere in this verse does it say that. But the interesting point is, if the rapture happened in Revelations 4:1, then millions of uncountable Christians would be around the throne from Revelations 4:1 all through the 7 years, if this was really the rapture. But if that was so, if all the church showed up at the throne in Revelations 4:1, then in Revelation 7:9, when the elder said, who are these in white robes that have just showed up that cannot be numbered? You know what? He wouldn't have noticed that more in white robes showed up. If all of the millions of Christians from all time were raptured in Revelation 4:1, the throne would have been so crowded with millions and millions of Christians that for another batch to show up, it wouldn't even have been noticed.
Hold that thought, John. We're going to be back here in just a moment with John Shorey, and we're going to be talking. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, John makes the point that suddenly as you read about the end of the sixth seal, and again, as you go into the second seal, a seventh seal, why, of course, the angels or some of the in heaven, they suddenly said, look at all those people there. Look at all those. Where did all those people come from, those people in white robes? Well, of course, it's assumed that this is the rapture. But now we're talking about after the opening of the sixth seal. This is getting very, very close to the very end of the of Revelation, getting up. What is that, Revelation 13 or 14?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
What is the reference that where the they're saying, well, where did all those people come from? Where
oh, yeah, that's Revelation 7:9.
Revelation 7:9. Okay, go right ahead.
Yeah, so that is my point, is that if the rapture happens in Revelation 4:1, where we know that all the Christians, once the rapture happens, from all of time, which would be certainly uncountable numbers, once the rapture happens, we would be with Christ. The Bible says that we would be Christ with Christ forever and ever. So Christ is certainly at the throne of God. And in Revelation 7:9, when the elder says, who are these who have just showed up around the throne? Well, he wouldn't even have noticed that. And in fact, there's another scripture in Revelation 5 where it talks about an event happening around the throne. And you know what? In Revelation 5, at this time, it talks about all the heavenly beings around the throne, and it literally puts a number on them. It says, you know, thousands upon thousands are around the throne, and yet there's no mention of the saints in white robes in Revelation 5. Well, if the rapture happened in Revelation 4:1, they would be at the throne, and the number around the throne would be uncountable. But they are able to put a count on it. If you study Revelation 5 about this event, which I cover more extensively in my book. And then when we get to Revelation 7:9, where the elder says, who are these multitudes that cannot be counted? He noticed that they arrived. And like I say, this is very difficult to explain from a pre-trib standpoint.
And I really think as you read John's book, you begin to really begin to think entirely differently about so many of the things we're told about the rapture. But anyway, before we go on, John, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, your website, and I know that you will answer questions if people have them. Now, we are going to carry the book because we think it's a very important book. But I want you to be able to get in touch with John if you have any question. How can people get in touch with you or get your material?
Well, you know, I have a website called tribulationtruth.com, www.tribulationtruth.com. You can see a picture of the book. You can go and actually see previews of the chapters in there. And Dr. Stan is going to be making this book available through, you know, through his radio station. But I like to help people to understand what I've written. And I get letters almost every day from people thanking me for writing this book. And I try to help answer any questions that you have. And at that website, tribulationtruth.com, you can actually contact me, ask me questions. And as long as you don't inundate me with too many questions, I will do my best to answer your questions.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, basically, John takes you through the opening of all of the seals. And basically, of course, as we get to the end of the seals, why it appears that at that point the rapture has taken place, but it doesn't take place early as most people anticipate. And basically, of course, John feels that the rapture occurs halfway through the seven-year period, and then things really begin to fall apart. In fact, as it says in the scriptures, you know, certainly everybody would be eliminated if God didn't come eventually, you know, to put an end to all of this. But you go right ahead with your description, John.
Well, you know, What really concerns me for the church is the fact that in Thessalonians, where it says, don't be deceived, for the gathering will not happen until there be a falling away and the man of sin is revealed. Well, that falling away, you know, when you understand my timeline and realize that when the economies of the world collapse, that will lead, I believe, very quickly to the forming of a one-world government. When that event happens, we will move rapidly to the seal, and when the seals happen and the Antichrist is revealed, then we are on a time clock that is so predictable with events all falling into place. I have laid this out on the timeline chart in my book.
But because terrible things are going to happen during that time, there's going to be terrible wars, there's going to be terrible famine, there's going to be certainly this war, one quarter of the world, it looks like almost a quarter of the world is going to be destroyed. All of these things are happening before, certainly, the rapture of the church. Is that correct?
Well, you know, I show that a catastrophic event, I mean, the collapse of currency globally, is a catastrophic event. And when that happens to where there's panic buying of food, the food delivery infrastructure collapses, within days, literally, your stores will not have food for you to buy to be able to exist. And your credit cards will be flipped off like a switch. And there'll be anarchy in the cities and riots. It will be an absolute mess. And what bothers me is that we have all been so indoctrinated that before any of this bad stuff happens, we're out of here. Well, when that event happens, and we are not out of here. This is going to cause many, many Christians to question the teaching of their pastors. Some people are going to just literally be so mad at their pastors. They're going to blame God. They're going to think that God has abandoned them because we've been taught we will not go through hard times. And this is going to lead to, I believe, a great falling away before the Great Tribulation even starts. And this ties into an event that happened in history just before the Second World War. Over in Europe, as Europe was heading into war, there was a strong church in Europe, and they were being taught that the rapture was imminent. They were saying we're entering the last days, that Hitler could easily be the Antichrist, and that, don't worry, because before things get bad, we're going to be raptured out of here. Well, what ended up happening is the church in Europe went through persecution, tribulation, millions were martyred, and because the rapture didn't happen, the surviving church was devastated, and they never recovered from this devastation. The church literally died in Europe, and that was a game plan of Satan, and I believe he is smiling today because he's about ready to launch it again on America, that we have been mistaught, just like Europe, that we would not go through tribulation, and it's going to be a sad day. We're not ready for that.
And another thing, of course, that John brings out, and he came to this conclusion on his own, and that is, there's a reference, of course, in the Revelation to Babylon and the destruction of Babylon. Well, of course, Babylon is, you know, the ancient Babylon's long since destroyed. There's nothing there. But there's a modern-day Babylon. At the times that are being outlined in the Revelation, and basically, of course, what happens is there's it is the financial center of the world. But why don't you pick up your thoughts? Because as I read your thoughts on the Babylon, the destruction of modern Babylon, they were so similar to my own thoughts. But go right ahead. What did you glean reading the scriptures about the destruction of the financial center of the world?
Well, you know, it's referred to as Mystery Babylon, okay? And it describes a nation that is like a center of commerce for the world. And if you go and read in Revelation about this country called Mystery Babylon, it literally talks about, you know, global trade. It talks about a land that's surrounded by water, and the merchants of the earth mourn at the loss, seeing the smoke rise from it. And, you know, there are some people that think that the literal land of Babylon is going to turn into a prosperous land that would be almost, you know, almost like China or America. And I don't see this at all. I see Mystery Babylon as referring to a country that didn't exist. And that country is America. You realize that the United States is the only superpower that didn't exist when the Bible was written. Well, you know, if it was referring to the land of Babylon, that wouldn't even be a mystery. But if it was referring to a land and a country, a superpower, that didn't exist when the Bible was written, that would be a mystery.
Well, anyway, of course, they describe this, certainly the destruction of this nation, and basically the merchants of the world weep because they have nobody to sell their products to. The whole financial system seems to have collapsed with the collapse of Mystery Babylon. And that, of course, it describes the ship captains, and they're looking back at this great city. And of course, they're seeing the burning and the smoke. And basically, if we're talking about a major cataclysmic event, so it destroys a major city, but it is the financial center of the world. What's the financial center of the world today? Well, of course, it's New York City, the financial center of the world. And basically, if New York were to disappear tomorrow, the whole world financial system would collapse. Go right ahead, John.
Well, you know, this brings up an interesting point that I hear from time to time, and that is where people actually believe that because the United States is not mentioned in the Bible, that what's going to happen in the last days will happen over in Europe and other parts of the world. and that the United States, we wouldn't have to take the mark of the beast, that we could just continue to do our own thing. And I'll tell you, this is wishful thinking. The Bible says that the Antichrist will rule over every people, every language, every nation. And America, the United States, is a nation. And you know, Satan, who will take control of this world leader and become the Antichrist, it is his design that he will rule the world forever. So don't think for one moment that America will be allowed to just do our own thing and that Satan would not have designs over the whole world. We're not going to get a free ticket out of this.
No, I fear you're probably right, Sydney. I think you've done a great job. Sydney, what sort of response have you gotten from your book? Because, of course, you're challenging what is being taught in the vast majority of churches in the United States today, and that is the pre-tribulation rapture. And you're saying that the American Christians are going to go through terrible suffering. And, of course, then when the rapture comes, why, of course, there'll be a great falling away before the rapture comes. But certainly the saints are taken to heaven. They're described as the people there in the white robes. And then, of course, things really get bad, not only in America, but throughout the world. And certainly what you separate the first. And then the other thing is the temple. They're going to have the Jewish temple, aren't they?
Well, you know, in a part of my book, I have a chapter called Mid-Trib Rapture, I Make My Case. And that chapter has three parts. And one part is talking about six events that have to take place before the rapture. And, of course, you know, the first is that one world government has to be formed before the Antichrist can show up. And there'll be a great falling away, as I already explained. And then the Antichrist will be revealed. That has to happen before the rapture. But if you study the scripture, it literally says that the Antichrist, before the rapture, the Antichrist will desecrate the temple. Well, that means if the Antichrist is going to desecrate the temple before the rapture, that means the temple has to be rebuilt before the rapture. And I show all of this, all backed up with scripture. In fact, I have almost 500 Bible verses written out in my book so that people can follow along and see where this is coming from the Word of God.
And I think you do a great, great job. And now, of course, what are the 6 points that have to take place? Because you make certainly the world government, you talk about the temple. What are the other things that have to take place before this event occurs?
Okay, as I said, number one, as a one world government has to be in place before the rapture, before the Antichrist can even show up. Then in Thessalonians, it says there will be a great falling away. And I show this as an event that will happen before the one world government is in place. And then number three, the Antichrist must be revealed before the rapture. And number four, the temple has to be rebuilt because it says the Antichrist must desecrate the temple. So the temple has to be desecrated before the rapture. I show that from scripture. And yet also, the temple has to be rebuilt before he can desecrate it. And then the sixth event that has to happen is heavenly events will take place before the rapture. And you can see this. This is the sixth seal where it says the sun goes black and the moon does not give its light. And when you study the sixth seal along with Matthew 24 and Mark and Luke, all of them are showing outlines of the six seals. And literally, Matthew is showing that sixth seal where it says the sun goes dark and the moon does not give its light. And then it says, at that time. What does that word mean, at that time? Or another translation, then. It says, then they will see the sign of the Son of Man coming in the clouds. And it literally explains the angels going throughout the earth and gathering the saints. Let me tell you, it's so plain in the Word of God, and yet we have allowed teachers to put a spin on all of this to make it mean something that it really doesn't mean. I just want to encourage people, have an open heart. Think for yourself. Read these. You know, if we have time, I wouldn't mind reading a couple of small letters that I've received from people who have read my book.
Go right ahead. Let's at least get as many in as we can. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, here's one short letter. It says, "I am just reading your book. I am studying your book along with other books on the same subject. Yours is conclusively the best, most concise, and understandable. When I am finished, I will yell from the housetops to everyone I know." I received this other letter from a man who had a Bible degree. He says, "Mr. Shorey, Pastor Shorey," he said, "I received your book last Saturday. I have a Bible Institute degree from Liberty University, and I have studied prophecy since 1994. Thanks be to God that He used you to write this book. I believe the Holy Spirit has used you to write this book and do surgery in detail to the book of Revelation, an event soon to occur. I have already read to page 128, and it is hard to put it down. You make a compelling case for the mid-tribulation rapture as I have never, ever read before. And you prove it by using and allowing the Bible to interpret the Old Testament, by the Old Testament, giving meaning to the New Testament and vice versa, which I believe is the right method of interpretation. The window of the Lord's return is a masterpiece for the end times."
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's been John Shorey, and we've got a couple of minutes here to have you wrap up the program, about 3 minutes. What is the message you'd like to leave with our listeners out across America?
Are you speaking to me?
Yes, yes, God. Go right ahead, John.
Sorry. All I can say is that I would like to encourage you to read this study. You owe it to yourself. You know, as I have talked to many pastors, what really, really bothers me is I have talked to many pastors who have read my book, and they confide in me that they believe I am right, but they're afraid to bring this message to their church. So we have to go around the pastors. For whatever reason, they are afraid to tell you that we're going to have to go through hard times. So I want to encourage the church to study this. Study the word. In Thessalonians, Paul said the Thessalonians were of more noble character because they studied daily to see if what Paul said was correct. And I would encourage you to get this book and study it for yourself.
Well, I would certainly concur in that. I think that you did a great job. And, of course, I'm not a theologian, but I have a pretty good knowledge of the Bible, and I was fascinated by many of the things I learned from reading your book. And certainly I appreciate very much what you've done, and I think it's important that people begin thinking about what's going on. I think we're moving into difficult times. And as you point out so well, and I certainly concur, my fear is that, and your fear, is that many Christians are going to turn away from the faith when things get bad because they've been so convinced that the pre-tribulation rapture is true. And basically, it's almost as if it's taught as if it's part and parcel of Scripture, whereas it simply is a theory and we don't know. Oh, but of course, there's much in the Scriptures that point out that difficult times are coming and Christians are going to have to live through that. Would you concur?
Absolutely. And you know, one last thought I would like to leave with the people that are listening is that we have a purpose for going through this tribulation. Our eternity is secure. We need to realize that and realize that our being here during these times is for the purpose of our leading others to Christ. And you know, I share a story about the Titanic, about how the lifeboats were only half full. And the people that survived the sinking of the Titanic lived with guilt, realizing they could have gone in and pulled people out of the water that were drowning. And my thought is, why are we
hold
so
that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. The significance of John's book is it is going to stimulate you, hopefully, to begin to study the Scriptures. How he does a very unique thing. And that is that he goes over many of these verses repeatedly. And basically, of course, as those of you who listen to our programs know that we often go over the same subject again and again and again. Why? Because that's how you teach. That's how people remember. And one of the biggest and most significant things about John's book is that you see these key scriptures again and again and again until you become very, very familiar with them. But the book is well worthwhile. It will stimulate people to begin going back and studying the scriptures. John Shorey, thank you so very much for your book. And the book is, of course, The Window of the Lord's Return. God bless, and we'll be talking to you real soon. Thank you so very much. Good night, John.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan. And if you'd like to get the book, The Window of the Lord's Return, why it's available, and, of course, by calling 1-800-544-8927. We're going to be carrying the book, The Window of the Lord's Return. We've already ordered them. They're on the way. We're going to put together a four-tape set on this, a couple of interviews with John, a couple of interviews with other people who agree with this basic position. And you can simply, if you want to order the four CD set as well, you can. Or suddenly it's not going to be ready, though, probably for another 3 or 4 weeks. But, of course, I think it's vitally important that you hear this, that you learn to be conversant with it, and learn to be able to actually discuss it intelligently. And then go back and read the 6th chapter of Revelation. It'll give you a whole different view of what's going on there. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported, and if you're in a position to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, we'd love to hear from you. If not, if you could subscribe to the newsletter or just get our products or perhaps advertise with us or certainly whatever you can do, why we'd ask you to. And if you're not in a position to help financially, and I know that many people are not, then we simply ask you to pray for our ministry, for our provision and protection, because we're on the front lines of this battle, and I really do believe that the prayers have kept us going and kept us safe. And since I've been in this, a number of people have dropped out of this movement, this small movement that's trying to educate the people. Others have died under very, very mysterious circumstances. A number of the people I've interviewed have died under very mysterious circumstances. But we're still here for one reason or another, and I do believe it's God's will that we're doing what we're doing, and we appreciate your prayers. And then, of course, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, let me suggest, because this will certainly help you to understand what is going on today from a political and an ideological point of view. But then, of course, none of this makes sense unless you understand the spiritual component of what's going on, because basically this is a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And the question is the Bible relevant today? And I believe it really is. I don't think you can really understand the things that are coming down the line. And you understand there is a master plan to bring about a one-world government, to bring about a one-world financial system. And that's why they're destroying the system. And that's why things are happening and have been happening over in Cyprus recently. And I think this infectiousness, this destruction of the monetary system is going to spread across Europe and eventually will spread to the United States. I believe there's going to be some cataclysmic event, and we don't know how it's going to unfold. But I think that, of course, if we have the Bible as a roadmap, when we see these events occur, we'll begin to understand them so much better. Well, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there. I certainly live for certainly 4 hours a day, archived 24 hours a day. You can watch our DVDs, or you can read our newsletters, and certainly our more recent newsletters are being written by our good friend William Grigg. But then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please also pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so we'll be back in just a moment.
For a prophecy, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful. Oh,
this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion and delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views expressed here, not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and hopefully, very, very shortly, they're going to be the views of William Grigg. And William, of course, was for many years the senior editor of the New American Magazine. And for a tight time, he was editor of the Republic Magazine. He certainly writes regular blogs. You can go to his website. You'll find him regularly featured at Lou Rockwell, and certainly one of the finest areas and sites up there on the internet. But he certainly writes about all of the things that are going on today, has a tremendous view and grasp of what's taking place. But of course, we're very privileged and pleased to have him as a writer. He writes the monthly Radio Liberty newsletter. I'm getting to the point where it takes me too long to write it, and there's so many other things we're doing. We're in the process of trying to record some of the really important things about population control that you really need to understand, and the genocidal agenda that is currently being waged against humanity. It's not happening by accident, it's happening by intent. I'm going to ask my producer to actually pass William through if he's available at this time so we can get started. Otherwise, I don't want to have to open the lines for regular callers, but it's vitally important that you have a grasp of what's going on today. We're moving into uncharted financial water, certainly what happened over in Cyprus when they went ahead and basically started just taking people's money because the banks were in trouble. Ordinarily, of course, you'd let the banks go down. But the banks didn't go down. They did not charge the people who run the banks for making faulty loans. They aren't held responsible. If you have your money in the bank, now they've established the precedent that they can take your money if the bank gets into trouble. You don't put your money in the bank, you know, simply to guarantee the bank. You don't benefit from their investments. I mean, you put your money in the bank so it'll be secure, and money in the bank is no longer secure. Yes, we have the Federal Deposit Insurance Company here in the United States, but the trouble is that the Federal Deposit Insurance, FDIC Corporation, doesn't have sufficient funds to cover. Oh, certainly, what they have $25 billion, and there is, at present time, on deposit in the banks, something around the neighborhood of $9 trillion. If the banks started to fail, how far do you think that $25 billion would go? Sheila Bair, who actually headed the FDIC for many years, and certainly you may have seen her on television, you probably did, during the crisis back in 2008, but she eventually, of course, left the FDIC, and I've interviewed her, and she just says that the whole system is simply essentially founded on quicksand, and there's going to be terrible, terrible problems down the line. Well, right now, we've got William with us. Hi, William. How are you tonight?
Dr. Stan, it's always a pleasure to be with you. I certainly appreciate this opportunity.
Well, tell us a little bit about what are we going to be talking about tonight.
You mentioned the FDIC, the so-called Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is one element of the multifarious fraud that is the federal government and the banking system. And I don't know if you have had a chance to discuss this with the audience, but last December, the FDIC and the Bank of England produced a 15-page report outlining the policy of confiscation of bank deposits in order to pay for bailouts that we have seen field-tested in Cyprus. And the thing that I find most ominous about this paper and this development is that they make it very clear that what money you have in the bank does not belong to you, and it is theirs to use at their discretion. And we're going to see Cyprus-style confiscations happen across the Eurozone, perhaps here in the United States as well.
In fact, I think it's so interesting. I'm consider myself fairly well read, but I hadn't heard about that at all. That's one reason I'd love to have you on, William. You're on top of so many things that most people would never be on top of. We're going to be back in just a moment with William Grigg. William, you go right ahead.
Well, Dr. Stan, we were talking about this paper that was published last December 10th specifically, by the FDIC, the so-called Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, like practically everything else that the government's involved in, the four words that compose the name of the agency are four lies. They're not involved in insuring deposits by any means. And what we find out in this paper, it was co-written by the FDIC and the Bank of England, published on December 10th of last year. They were talking about the policy of confiscating bank deposits in order to pay for bailing out national governments and banking institutions. And this actually was a policy that coalesced out of discussions that had taken place within the G20 Financial Stability Board of Basel, Switzerland. And of course, that's another fraudulent entity. And what happened in Cyprus is that an appendage of this interconnected nexus of corruption that exists between the banking institutions, the transnational and multilateral governmental organizations, is that they field tested this approach, where they were talking about using private deposits to indemnify national debt, in this case, debt by a constituent member of the Eurozone, and also the debts of politically connected banks. That document is entitled Resolving Globally Active, Systematically Important Financial Institutions. And that's typical of the approach of these people. They swaddle their evil proposals in prose that is genuinely prosaic and tends to induce sleep in those who try to read and understand what's going on. And I am indebted to an analyst by the name of Ellen Brown. She publishes the Web of Debt blog, and she also writes for Alternet, which is a left-leaning, somewhat populist online publication. I've actually had some material that I've sent to them, and they've been somewhat receptive to my point of view with respect to the war on drugs and other issues.
Well, it's interesting. We had Ellen on just yesterday. We go right ahead.
Yeah, okay. This is somebody who obviously knows a lot of what's going on, forgotten more about this subject than I'll probably ever learn. The thing is that she renders this into intelligible prose. And what she points out is the following. Although few depositors realize it, legally the bank owns the depositor's funds as soon as they are put in the bank. Our money becomes the bank's. We become unsecured creditors holding IOUs or promises to pay. But until now, the bank has been obligated to pay the money back on demand in the form of cash. Under the FDIC Bank of England plan, our IOUs will be converted into bank equity.
Hold that thought, because I think this is so vitally important for our listeners. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is saying that a report came out December 10th of last year, and it had to do with, of course, certain banking institutions, the FDIC and others, and certainly they came up with this idea and then this statement that no longer when you put your money in the bank is that your money. It now belongs to the bank, and they give you an IOU, which, of course, is your receipt for putting the money in the bank, but they don't have to give it back to you. They know that the whole world financial system is totally corrupt. It's overlent, and so many of our banking institutions have made so many bad loans, and certainly having to do with the housing bubble back there in 2007 and 2008. And so basically, we are going to have to then, the people who have money in the bank, we're going to have to let the banks take that money, and as they did in Cyprus. Now, Cyprus, according to William, and I think he's right, was a trial run. But basically, as I watched what was unfolding in Cyprus, it didn't make any sense. I mean, here's a small island. Yes, they had, the banks were in real trouble, but basically, we're talking about a few billion dollars. They were going to get a loan of, I think, somewhere between $10 and $13 billion from the European Central Bank and from the IMF and from the European Union, and they were simply all set to give that to them, but with a proviso that the banks had to actually seize the bank accounts and then, of course, make up, I think, about $5 or $6 billion. Now, to these people, money is of no consequence. I mean, we saw during the crisis in 2008 when the Federal Reserve Board created simply about 16 trillion, not billion, not million, $16 trillion for a few days to simply see the banks through the difficult time. They could create this simply by a banking entry, $16 trillion for banks, not just in America, but throughout the world. And they could have certainly done this with Cyprus, which only talking about $5 or $6 billion. But as I saw what was unfolding, it became very obvious this was a trial of something else. What we were seeing certainly had nothing to do with the situation in Cyprus. There was a reason for it, and it's just that they were using the crisis to justify coming up with this concept that was perfectly acceptable for banks to seize the money that had been deposited with them. And, of course, basically, initially they were talking about 9% of all the bank accounts over 100,000 euros. And now it sounds more like 40% of those bank accounts over 40,000 euros. And, of course, one of the things people say, well, but the Russians got a lot of their money out. They went to some of the other branches that weren't the banks in Cyprus, but in other countries that weren't closed. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, but the major pension funds had all of their money. The pension funds from Cyprus, their money was in the banks, deposited in the banks, and those pension funds are now going to become insolvent. And Cyprus is going to be suffering for a long period of time because of this financial crisis. And I believe this is foreshadows what's going to happen throughout Europe and throughout the United States. William, you pick up the story. And if you disagree with me, please go ahead and
I think there's nothing to disagree with in your summation there, which is very detailed and comprehensive. And I think that what's happened in Cyprus is a beta test, if you will, of something that's going to be applied in other countries in the Eurozone. There's already been serious mention of the same thing being done in Italy and Spain and Portugal, in other regions of what's called the southern part of the Eurozone, which are very much plagued with debt, and you're seeing all kinds of social turmoil and dislocations as a result. And it really didn't make a whole lot of sense that in this obscure little island, which, of course, has been a source of great conflict between Greece and Turkey, among other countries, and in the banking realm, you've got sort of a proxy war going on between German and Russian interests, as you alluded to, Dr. Stan. Why would they focus upon this particular crisis in Cyprus, which is by no means of a magnitude comparable to what's going on in neighboring Greece, or some of the things that are happening elsewhere in the Eurozone? The answer, I suspect, is what Elman Brown has referred to, that you have this strategy which was discussed in this document. Once again, the title of it, a very jargon-laden title, is Resolving Globally Active, Systemically Important Financial Institutions. And just to reprise what she was saying here, our money, when we deposit it in the bank, technically belongs to the bank. What she says is that until now, the bank has been obligated to pay the money back on demand in the form of cash. Under the FDIC Bank of England plan, our IOUs will be converted into bank equity. The bank will get the money, and we will get stock in the bank. Now, that reminds me a little bit of what happened in 2008 when all these debt-laden and fraudulent institutions, the most notorious, I think, being AIG and the counterparties that were involved in AIG, all kinds of horrible manipulation and fraud, we ended up buying AIG, we, the taxpayers, through this so-called liquidity that was created by the Federal Reserve and then channeled into AIG and through AIG to Citi and some of the other institutions by the Congress. And the other TARP institutions, of course, were bailed out in exactly the same way. This was done through the creation of currency, through currency manipulation by the Fed. What happened in Cyprus and what's likely to happen elsewhere is that you're going to see the direct confiscation of bank deposits. And what is purely and truly horrifying about what's going on in Cyprus, Dr. Stan, is that they are pursuing a Carthaginian destruction. That's somewhat of a mixed metaphor geographically. Carthage, of course, was in northern Africa and not in the Mediterranean, but it's not that far away. They're pursuing a Carthaginian destruction of the entire business economy, commercial economy of Cyprus. And by way of illustrating that, there was a horrifying post that was made by a Cypriot businessman on an online forum devoted to Bitcoin, which of course is this virtual currency transfer mechanism that has shot through the roof as sort of a currency surrogate. I'm reluctant to call Bitcoin an actual currency. It's hopefully a person-to-person, unmediated currency exchange mechanism where you can get out of the banking system. I don't know what to think of it. Mine's more subtle and better equipped than mine are trying to fathom its mysteries right now. But among people who are involved in the Bitcoin economy, there are these online fora, and one of them had a post from a Cypriot businessman who discovered earlier this week after the banks were opened And that's, of course, a very important part of the story here. There was this prolonged banking holiday, and you still have sort of a quasi-holiday going on in Cyprus right now. He discovered that the government, on orders from the European Commission, and acting on behalf of the IMF, ultimately, and the people who are behind this plan for confiscation, they had stolen more than 80% of the money in his account. He operated a mid-sized IT, information technology company, and he says that the same thing has happened to thousands of other businessmen in this country. He had something on the order of a little more than 780,000, I think, euro in his bank account, and the government or the bankers, or do I repeat myself, simply blocked 5/6 of his available funds. These were supposedly funds that he had earned. They were the operating capital for his business. So he had to discharge almost his entire workforce. He says that he knows thousands of other businessmen on Cyprus who've done exactly the same thing. These people are now newly unemployed. They're cast out of the workforce into an economy that is entirely wrecked. And what social safety net exists, and of course Cyprus, like most other constituent members of the EU, is ruled by a socialist government, a government that's somewhat close to Russia, as it turns out. What social safety net exists, of course, has been completely shredded, and they most likely don't have access to their own personal funds either, because these people most likely were making enough, earning enough, and banking enough that they would be getting a haircut, which actually is more akin to what somebody would receive by way of a guillotine rather than by way of a barber. But these people are most likely seeing their own funds impounded just after their business has been destroyed. And what he said is that he's taking what little operating capital he has offshore from Cyprus, which had been an offshore haven for a lot of people in Europe and particularly in Russia. And you mentioned, Dr. Stan, that there have been reports that some of the politically connected Russian oligarchs who have used Cyprus as an offshore banking haven received some advance notice as to what was going to happen, and they were able to get their funds out. But the common people are actually just part of the productive economy there, didn't have that advantage. And what this gentleman says is that they're going to take what assets they still retain and probably relocate to a country in the Caribbean where authorities, and I'm quoting his word now, where authorities have more respect to people's assets. Now, the ironic thing is that he's almost certainly not going to be bringing those assets to the United States, because the one thing that we have learned in the wake of the October Revolution of 2008 in the United States is that every measurable increment of wealth in this country is considered to be at the disposal of those who are willing to confiscate it through inflation and through redistribution of wealth legislatively on behalf of the bankers. And so he's not going to be bringing those assets to the United States. He's most likely going to end up putting them in some offshore haven such as Cayman Islands or someplace of that sort. But this is what's going on in Cyprus right now, pursuant to this despicable plan that was referred to by Ellen Brown, that was created last December 10th by the FDIC and the Bank of England.
But I think what's really so important for people to understand, William, is the fact that businesses have to have capital to be able to run. And basically, you take away their capital, or they have to shut down. And basically, businesses have to know that they put money in the bank, they're going to be able to get the money they put in the bank out of the bank. So the confidence begins to break down in the banking system, which of course it should have done a long time ago, but it's almost as if they're planning on this, as if they want to wreck the world banking system, or the national, or as in the case of the European Union, the internationalist system. But I believe, of course, what we're going to come up with is a world financial system, because that's been the plan for a long time. Destroy this system, take away the people are going to be desperate. I mean, you're not going to operate a business if you can't have capital in the bank so you can pay your salaries. And I think they have a solution. They create the problem, and the solution is a new world order, a new world financial system, a new world religion, and maybe even a new world leader. We'll be right back. Go right ahead, William.
I think that your analysis is sound and perfectly horrifying, and it's entirely logical to believe that what we're seeing in the publicly available documents, as horrifying as it is something that produces something kind of a barricade against an examination of the really ugly things that these people plan. And extrapolating from where we are right now, extrapolating from the facts that are available, it makes perfect sense that behind the engineered destruction here of this conventional banking system is a plan to institute a new world money system of the sort that you describe. And I wouldn't be surprised to see a cascading series of bank runs, bank holidays, confiscations, and national and then regional bank failures that would eventually lead to a global bank run. That wouldn't include perhaps a couple of isolated little pools of relative stability that are not fully integrated into the system. And eventually that will bring about a climacteric, a grand crisis where we will see the unveiling of this long planned, long anticipated world money system, which of course has a certain really ominous and apocalyptic resonance for those of us who read some of the scarier sections of the Bible, such as the Book of the Apocalypse, the Book of Revelation. I mean, there's certainly that resonance there that we simply can't ignore. For those who don't credit the prophecies of the Bible, the economic logic is, I think, comparably terrifying. The fact that the same people who've engineered these fraudulent institutions would have undifferentiated power over a money system that would give them the ability to manipulate our ability to provide the necessities of life and leave us completely vulnerable, completely dependent upon them. That's the dream that has long inspired the evil machinations of would-be tyrants and dictators since Nimrod was wandering around the Near East building his own regime and making people dependent upon him and his oligarchy. And I don't like reflecting upon possibilities of that sort, and I don't see how any rational person would, but that's something that I think is a responsible assessment of where we're headed, and it's likely that we're headed there much more quickly than some people, myself among them, would have expected. And I think as well, when we're talking about bank runs and collapsing institutions, this is something which is innate to the fractional reserve banking system. By strict definition, all fractional reserve banks are insolvent. The way that they operate, they create something of a self-replicating machinery of fraud. It's a bit like in science fiction, the concept of the von Neumann machine, which is an instrument that can take the raw materials that surround the given von Neumann machine and replicate duplicates of itself until it completely devours whatever raw material is available. In some of the more interesting applications of that in science fiction, these machines will eventually destroy entire worlds or entire solar systems and build little omnivorous replicas of themselves that spread out and wreak havoc across the extended star system or galaxy. Well, taking that and transposing it from science fiction into economic reality, I think that's the logic, if you will, of fractional reserve banking, especially when it's wedded to the practice of fiat currency generation. And what's really scary here is that while we're taking a look at what's going on in this little previously obscure island of Cyprus, there's a much larger island chain and much more.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg, and of course we're talking about what's happening in Cyprus. And this was simply a trial, basically to see how it would work. And basically, of course, this, I believe, foreshadows the fact that any money you have in the bank will very soon be looked upon not as your deposit, but as your loan to the bank, or the fact that the bank can claim that money and just give you an IOU. And when you want to get the money out, you're not going to be able to get it out, or you're only going to be able to get a limited amount at a time. And when that happens, the whole structure, the whole financial structure of society will begin to break apart. Of course, this is what's happening in Cyprus. Corporations, companies over in that island are just picking up and leaving. They can't operate. They can't get their money out of the bank. They've lost a lot of their money. And if they want to operate at all, they have to be someplace where there's a stable banking system, and so they'll go elsewhere. But what they do not understand is that all of the banks in the world are interlocked through the central banking system, and eventually down the line, I fear the same thing will happen to banks in Europe. In other words, basically, they'll be able to take and keep the money deposited in the bank. And the same thing will happen, of course, to the situation here in the United States. But go right ahead, William.
Not only do we see this happening in Cyprus, but what really haunts my sleep now, indeed causes sleep to become a stranger, is the fact that in Japan, which is one of, if not the major sources of subsidy for the T-bills that sustain the federal government's operations here in this country, Japan is still a pillar of the world banking structure. There is discussion now of monetizing their own debt, which is running at a huge ratio. I can't remember what it was, but it's several hundred to one in terms of their debt-to-revenue ratio for their own operation. And this is really terrifying because Japan, of course, for the last roughly, 23 years, has been in a depression. They have been able to surmount a lot of the familiar problems of a depression because they had a very high savings rate. The Japanese would earn a great deal, and they would save most of what they earn. China, of course, has been doing a similar thing, at least large sections of that economy. Of course, there are, 1.3 billion Chinese. There are, I think, about 30 million people who belong to the Chinese Communist Party. And, of course, they have the legislative power and the military to enforce their will, but still a very large country, and Chinese are industrious. They tend to be very thrifty. Well, in Japan, they had a very high savings rate, and they were able to deal with their own financial and economic slump through savings rather than through the issuance of fiat currency. And it was out of the Japanese savings, Chinese savings, that you had the type of capital that was used to buy up American debt. Well, it turns out now that Japan has reached the end of its ability to sustain this unsustainable course of action. And there's discussion now of radical devaluation of the yen in order to monetize their own indebtedness. And what that's going to do most likely is to set off, first of all in Asia, and then of course by way of contagion pretty much everywhere else, what's called a currency war. And a currency war, of course, is a race to the bottom in terms of currency. In the Eurozone, of course, you've got a completely notional currency that is fiat by definition. It's, as I've said before, an ersatz currency issued by a largely hypothetical political body that doesn't represent an actual nation or a political entity with any history. That's one of the reasons why the euro notes are decorated, if you will, or disfigured, as I prefer to say, with pictures of people who haven't lived and buildings that have yet to be constructed. But you have other fiat currencies, just to say pretty much all the currencies of the world, the most notorious being the U.S. dollar, that are going to be affected by what the yen, what is done to the yen. And so while we're worrying about what's going on in Cyprus, and of course Cyprus is a cup of trembling for those who have understood the warnings about what this portends, what's going on in Japan, of course, could be the lethal development, the lethal break with the current system that leads the direction of this new global currency and new global banking and centrally planned economy that we've been talking about and that many of us have been warned and have been warning about for many decades. So that's something else that we can that we should be taking into account. And in that same neighborhood, of course, we hear war drums resounding from the Korean Peninsula, which has great relevance, of course, to what goes on in Japan. There's a very long history, most of it unpleasant, in Japan and Korea. And the fact that we appear to see out of practically nowhere the prospect of a resumption of the shooting war that's been held in abeyance now for 60 years. It was never ended. You have an armistice, not a peace treaty. That's something I think plays into this as well, because a war in that region, like a war in pretty much any other strategically crucial region, would be disastrous for the world economy. It's disastrous that people would eagerly capitalize upon.
One of the what's even more interesting, William, is that the North Korean dictator has announced that certainly if war comes, he will attack Los Angeles and New York and Austin, Texas. Austin, Texas?
Yeah.
We'll be back in just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in a world gone mad, but most people have no idea that our leaders are insane.
While the storm clouds gather, swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer.
Well, William, you go right ahead.
I did find it odd as well that on the target list he had not merely Hawaii and San Diego and Washington and a number of other cities that are supposedly menaced by North Korea's fanciful arsenal of ICBMs, but also Austin, Texas. That puzzled me a great deal, trying to figure out what would have earned Austin such malign attention on the part of Kim Jong-un and his military oligarchy. And then it occurred to me that perhaps it might have something to do with the fact that the University of Texas at Austin has a computer laboratory that is involved in some secondary or tertiary role with the Pentagon. Or maybe it just seemed as good as any target in Texas in order to get the attention of people in that state. It strikes me as ludicrous that we would live in fear that the North Koreans would have the ability to harm the United States. They don't. It's a horrible government. They've got a very large military apparatus, starving their people to death, and they are sustained and prolonged in their reign by corrupt interests, not only, of course, in China, but also in the United States. That being said, they're primarily, if not exclusively, a menace, the ruling elite in North Korea. It's the people who live in Korea, and it makes no sense at all that we have had U.S. troops there stationed in the DMZ for many decades when South Korea is eminently capable of taking care of its own affairs, but they are there to be a tripwire. That's one of the reasons why we have these prolonged deployments. It's not to provide stability and protection for the United States. It's to leave the ground seeded with these tripwires that can be pulled in order to implicate the United States in all these pointless conflicts. It's one of the reasons why they're talking now about keeping a large U.S. presence in Afghanistan for at least the next decade. That's something that was made very clear by the recently retired general who was the commanding officer of U.S. Allied forces Afghanistan. He was never given instructions from the Obama administration to come up with a zero option plan for January of 2015. It was never envisioned that we would remove our troops from Afghanistan. There'll be a large drawdown of troops, but there are going to be many thousands of U.S. troops remaining in Afghanistan, just as there are mercenaries and military contractors who remain in Iraq.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is William Reagan. He's simply pointing out that suddenly we have our troops in South Korea. We've had our troops in South Korea since the war ended back in 1954. Why are troops there? Well, certainly for the same reason we have our troops. Over 35,000 troops in Japan, over 45,000 troops in Germany. Here we're talking well over 60, 65 years after World War II ended, and we still have our troops there. And basically, of course, it's William's contention that we want our troops in South Korea as a justification for perhaps precipitating a war with North Korea. And certainly, is that possible? I mean, certainly we could wipe North Korea off the face of the map. Certainly with half a dozen of our B-2 bombers armed with nuclear weapons. But have anybody ever stopped and wondered what would happen if North Korea would launch, say, a half a dozen electromagnetic pulse bombs and in correspondence with Iran launching a certain number of EMP weapons into the stratosphere and wiped out the entire electronic system of the United States? It could happen. We know how to stop it. We know how to prevent it. We've known for a dozen years what to do, and we've never done it. And Congress has voted to actually look into this, and nothing's ever happened. And we have to ask why so much is going on today that just doesn't make sense from a logical point of view. So there has to be another agenda. William, pick up the story.
Indeed, we seem to live in a all-encompassing global logic free zone when it comes to politics and economics. And I suppose it was ever thus to some extent, but the op tempo of insanity has increased dramatically just in the last 3 or 4 months. And we were already at the what I assume was the top speed of the treadmill in that respect before the beginning of the new year. But things have deepened and broadened in terms of the ambient irrationality of the system that surrounds us here. And with respect to the electromagnetic pulse, and this is some advice that people who are specialized instructors with respect to survival have offered. I don't consider myself to be in any way qualified to do anything other than retail their wisdom in this. But it's probably a pretty good idea for people who are worried about the possibility of an EMP or the likelihood of a coronal mass ejection or some other solar incident. And we're approaching, of course, the solar maximum here, and that has some really interesting implications for a wired world, is to learn how to construct a rudimentary Faraday cage. Something can be done with an anodized garbage can, if nothing else. Just find some place to store certain critical electronics that you will need in an emergency situation. And you'd have to make a household inventory of the communications devices and the other devices without which you'd have a very hard time getting by. And find out, for instance, if the electronics in your automobile are such that they would be fried by an EMP or a solar event. You know, just you know, something to be done with the relatively modest expenditure of time and attention. And I think that beyond saying that it would be a good idea to acquire this capacity, I'd suggest that people simply go online and look into how to construct a Faraday cage. This is the sort of thing, of course, that provokes certain laughter, self-indulgent laughter at our expense among the bien pensants. I don't care. It's a far better idea to be a little bit prepared or to be a little bit overprepared than to be critically and tragically underprepared if there is a crisis. And that's another, if you will, appendage of this multi-tentacled beast that we confront right now, and that is the fact that the government ruling us is making it pretty plain that it's no longer going to be indulging those of us who are not well-disposed to being ruled. And just in the recent last couple of months, we've seen a steady and somewhat amplified and increasingly forceful effort to demonize so-called anti-government extremists and constitutional extremists. And that phrase, constitutional extremist, by the way, showed up in one of the more unlikely or more apparently unlikely places just over the last few days. And that was in a silly little program on the Fox Network, not the Fox News Channel, but the Fox Entertainment Network. There's this new drama starring Kevin Bacon where the protagonist is trying to investigate a terrorist plot involving, I guess, Al-Qaeda or some other off-the-shelf, eminently hissable, ready-made, prefabricated Muslim boogeyman, and a group of people who on camera refer to themselves as constitutional extremists. I don't know of anybody who, upon having a conversation with a recent acquaintance, is going to say, we're constitutional extremists, but that piece of overwrite dialogue was in the script that was broadcast, part of this broadcast just in the last couple of days. And once again, the scenario here is that for reasons rooted, I'm guessing, in sheer cartoonish malice, the so-called constitutional extremists, who are young men in their 20s, say they were raised in militias, are lending their aid and support to Muslim terrorists to bring down the United States of America. And that strikes me as a script that was probably hammered out on the keyboard of Mark Patak at the Southern Poverty Law Center, or somebody else similarly situated who is involved in generating these Stasi-style rosters of internal enemies on behalf of the Homeland Security Department on, once again, in sort of a unlikely website from the perspective of at least some people, RT News, Russia Today News. There was a fascinating story talking about the role played by federal fusion centers in tracking what they refer to as anti-government Americans. What is an anti-government American? Well, an anti-government American is somebody who engages in the type of supposedly seditious banter that we're having this evening, Dr. Stan, and reviewing the multitudinous and ever-expanding roster of iniquities that are carried out by people who impudently presume to rule us, now, people who are attached to the Constitution rather than to the government that ignores the Constitution, people to believe in individual liberty rather than in the power and privilege of the banking elite and the political class that they bought and paid for. This is what this RT News story says. Law enforcement intelligence processing fusion centers have long come under attack for spying on Americans. The Arkansas director wanted to clarify the truth. Centers only spy on some Americans, those who appear to be a threat to the government. In trying to clear up the misconceptions about the conduct of fusion centers, Arkansas State Fusion Center Director Richard Davis simply confirmed Americans' fears. The center does, in fact, spy on Americans, but only on those who are suspected to be anti-government. Quote, the misconceptions are that we are conducting spying operations on U.S. citizens, which, of course, is not a fact. That is absolutely not what we do, he told the NWA homepage, which is a homepage associated with a couple of TV stations in Arkansas, including Fox 24, Fox affiliate. After claiming that his office absolutely does not spy on Americans, he proceeded to explain that this does not apply to those who could be interpreted as a threat to national security. Davis said his office places its focus on international plots, quote, domestic terrorism and certain groups that are anti-government. We want to kind of take a look at and receive that information. But the First Amendment allows for freedom of speech and opinion, making it lawfully acceptable for Americans to express their grievances against the U.S. government, continues RT News. The number of anti-government groups even hit a record high in 2012, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. Southern Poverty Law Center, of course, is in everything but name and appendage of the Department of Homeland Security, or perhaps the Department of Homeland Security is an appendage of the SPLC. There's a certain evil symbiosis there. Many of these groups are, quote, hate groups that express disdain for minorities. But unless they become violent, these groups are legally allowed to exist. And then they quote Mark Patak here. Once again, we are seeing the fourth straight year of really explosive growth on the part of anti-government patriot groups and militias, says Mark Patak in an interview with Mother Jones. That's 913% in growth. We've never seen that kind of growth in any group we cover. And of course, that growth is largely a function of the expansive and ludicrous definitions used by the SPLC to define a hate group or an anti-government group. Most of the people who are considered anti-government by the SPLC are people who support the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, or people who understand the role played by the Founding Fathers and the doctrine of interposition and nullification that they articulated in keeping power disseminated and diffused rather than allowing it to become centralized in the hands of a corrupt elite in Washington. Of course, it was James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, you know, those notorious exponents of sedition and anti-government radicalism, who in 1798 wrote the documents, the Virginia and Kentucky Resolves, that outlined the explicitly described power of interposition and nullification that's protected through the Ninth and Tenth Amendments of the United States Constitution. The Ninth and Tenth Amendments, of course, part of the Bill of Rights. Their function is to reserve the individual rights, the unenumerated individual rights of the individual American citizens, and the reserved powers of the states that created the federal Constitution. And, of course, in recent years, there's been a very large and growing movement to nullify unconstitutional federal enactments, such as Obamacare, for one very good example, and a growing movement on the part of people, particularly certain county sheriffs, who are making it very clear that they will not implement unconstitutional infringements of the individual right to keep and bear arms. Now, this is the sort of development that the SPLC refers to when it talks about the growth of so-called anti-government extremism. And, of course, if the SPLC were simply generating these reports and hurling defamatory, abusive rhetoric at people who hold those views, this would be unpleasant, but it would not be a matter of moment in terms of public policy. However, the SPLC is not only affecting the public dialogue in the media and also apparently helping to ghostwrite scripts for silly primetime television programs on all the unlikely networks, Fox, but it's also having an impact on the perceptions of people who operate these fusion centers. These fusion centers exist pretty much everywhere. You can find multi-jurisdictional task forces headed by the FBI. And a fusion center, and I will use this expression in its specific and original sense, A fusion center is a law enforcement Soviet. What is a Soviet? It was understood by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. A Soviet is a ruling council. It's a body that integrates the local party apparatus with the central party apparatus. And the most important element of any given regional Soviet, the Soviet Union, was the security organs, the Cheka, as it was referred to when it was created back in 1917 by Felix Dzerzhinsky, and it was eventually called, of course, the OGPU, the NKVD, the KGB. It's called the FSB, or Federal Security Service, today. That's the role which is carried out by the FBI. The FBI is the political police, and for the last 10 or 11 years, they have spent most of their time generating these contrived ersatz plots on behalf of manipulable people within the Muslim population in our country. They've found socially marginalized and vulnerable people, often young men of great ambitions and some difficult social situation, who've been very carefully enticed into taking part in stupid and immoral activities by people who were employed by the federal government to carry out that function. The federal government, on at least one occasion that I've been able to document, has referred to those people as terrorism facilitators. And there's a fellow by the name of Craig Montiel, who is a petty criminal, as so many of these people are, who is recruited by the FBI with the explicit instruction, with a national security directive that was issued by the Bush White House several years ago, to infiltrate Muslim religious communities in Orange County as part of what was called Operation Flex. He was to go in there and try to entice or stimulate or provoke terrorist behavior. What happened in his case is that local Muslims were alarmed by the appearance of this guy who was trying to get them to say stupid things and trying to get them involved in some kind of radical or terrorist activity. They actually called the FBI and ratted out Montiel as somebody they considered to be a proto-terrorist. They actually called the Fusion Center. They called the Counterterrorism Center and said, there's this guy who showed up in our mosque who's talking about blowing things up and killing people. We think he might be a terrorist. And the FBI director, talking with the director of the mosque, said, well, that's very interesting. Thanks for calling. And, of course, he knew who this person was, knew what he was doing because he was running it. And rather than arresting the would-be terrorist, they arrested the people who were ratting him out. They arrested the people who were cooperating with the investigation and tried to extort cooperation from them to infiltrate other Muslim groups and precipitate some kind of prosecutable seditious rhetoric or some kind of involvement in these phony FBI orchestrated plots. That's what's been going on with the Muslims over the last 10 or 11 or 12 years. They're doing the same thing now with the so-called right-wing extremists and constitutional extremists.
I think it basically anybody who doubts this can go up on the internet and just type in fusion centers. You'll find out that they have recruited tens of thousands of informants. Last thing I heard, and this was several years ago, they had over 40,000 Americans who have become part of these fusion centers, and basically your best friend could be a member of one of these fusion centers, one of these cells. They're all about simply reporting to the federal government. They are informers. If you say anything at all, that can be used against you, and has probably been already reported to the FBI. Be very, very careful. Understand, the fusion centers are not imaginary. They're real. Go up on the internet, simply type in fusion centers, informants, and you'll find out that there are literally tens of thousands of people who are government informants. Your best friend could be one of them. Well, before we go on, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your website, how they get your writings, and how they can get your power to your basically PowerPoint program, to your basically to your little button there, and help you financially. And I would point out that my wife and I support William and want to help him and his six children. How can people get to you and your PayPal button?
Dr. Stan, I really do appreciate you. You've been a real blessing to me and to my family, and we really do appreciate everything you've done. My blog is called Pro Libertate. If you go to Google and type in P-R-O, Pro, and then Libertate, L-I-B-E-R-T-A-T-E, Pro Libertate, you'll be able to find my blog. It should be the first return. Just type in William N. Grigg or William N. Grigg and Pro Libertate. The direct address is freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And at the bottom of every essay, as you mentioned, Dr. Stan, there's a PayPal button for those who are part of the PayPal system or interested in providing support. We really do appreciate it. That's pretty much what sustains me and my family. You can probably appreciate this is a very difficult way to make a productive living in the best of times. We're not living in the best of times. These are severely suboptimal times. And so what we receive, of course, is very much cherished and husbanded very carefully and very much appreciated. And I also have a lot of my work republished at lewrockwell.com, lewrockwell.com.
And, of course, read what William has writes. It's well worthwhile. It's all important. And even more than that, of course, you'll certainly want to read of my newsletter because, of course, William writes it, and certainly a wonderful source of information. You'll certainly want to see the March newsletter, and that's available by calling us at 1-800-544-8927. Well, William, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up tonight's program.
Well, Dr. Stan, once again, it's a privilege and a blessing to be with you, and I do appreciate not only the opportunity to speak with you and with your audience, and also the help that you provided and the support that we've received from many people in your audience, for which we're very grateful. But the opportunity to talk with you and to express my gratitude to you for the decades that you've invested in the effort to articulate the truth and defend it at all hazards. That's been a source of great strength and inspiration to me. You mentioned the newsletter that I sent last week, and it dealt with a lot of these issues that we're seeing blossom into huge, nettlesome ugliness in the world financial system. What's really interesting is how much worse things have gotten just since I sent that newsletter to you. I mean, we've really reached a point now where the propagation curve, if you will, of this crisis has gone parabolic, and that really is something, once again, that resonates with some of the scarier passages that we read in the prophecies of the Bible, and it's something that we can see in the study of secular history. Like yourself, Dr. Stan, I'm a Christian believer, and I'm somebody who believes that the Bible is the distilled, digested wisdom, divinely inspired wisdom that includes prophetic insights into the future. But even those who don't share that perspective, and by the way, I wish everybody did, even those who don't share that perspective, just examining what's going on right now with an understanding of how history has unfolded and how crises in history that have been, if you will, sort of prologue to what we're dealing with right now, have overtaken people very quickly. That's something that I think should inspire everybody who's conscious of what's happening and concerned about the future of their families, their homes, their freedom, to do everything they can with not merely all deliberate speed, but with all possible speed to prepare for the genuinely ugly and tragic things that lay immediately ahead of us. It's going to get very, very scary very soon. So we have to take every effort we can to prepare ourselves as thoroughly as we can for what's going to unfold just immediately ahead of us.
I think you're absolutely right. And, of course, this is one of the things we do with our programs, and certainly one of the reasons I do what I do is to warn people to get them ready for the difficult times that lie ahead. And certainly if you need more information, ladies and gentlemen, of course, get hold of my ministry at Radio Liberty. One more time, your webpage where people can reach you.
freedominourtime.blogspot.com. That's one word, blogspot. freedominourtime.blogspot.com.
Okay, good night, God bless, and have a wonderful, wonderful Easter. You know, this is the time, of course, we celebrate the resurrection of our Lord, and that's what makes life worth living, to know that he really was resurrected. Good night.
Amen. He is risen indeed.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and simply I would comment that this is Easter, this is Good Friday, and there's certainly why, of course, we don't talk about this like we used to when I was raised. Good Friday was such an important day, and it is still an important day, despite the fact that there is a conspiracy against Christianity at the highest levels of our government today. And it has taken God and prayer, and any mention of Easter out of our schools, out of our government, they've taken away Christmas, certainly. And why we still even have that as a holiday, I mean, I'm just waiting for them to come on and try to stop them from having Christmas holidays. But that, it'll come down the line, because there is an active conspiracy against Christianity. Well, we have the knowledge, of course, that the Bible is true. I believe it's true. Well, not only because I certainly chose to believe it's true, but if you read the scriptures, you find that these things are coming to pass. And it's very, very difficult to understand many of the things that are going on in the world today, unless you understand that we are living in prophetic times. And once you understand that, and once you understand the prophecies, why so many of the things that are taking place begin to make sense. If you haven't read that book we talked about during the last hour, The Window of the Lord's Return, The Window of the Lord's Return by John Shorey, you'll want to get that. You'll certainly want to get the 4-CD set. Now, it won't be ready for a few weeks, but we'll have that available. And we think it's going to be vitally important. It will help you to reach others so they can begin to understand and correlate what is happening politically and culturally and financially with what is predicted prophetically. And we are truly living in, the times that are described in the scriptures. Either the Bible is accurate or the Bible is fraudulent. I believe it's accurate. I believe it's accurate because I see the things coming to pass that have been described, and we see the repeated fulfillment of prophecy. If you have not seen Pastor Billy Crone's wonderful DVD sets, now they're actually we have 5 different DVD sets. They're called certainly the Final Countdown, Part 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Each one has 5 CDs in it. But it will give you tremendous insight into what's happening. And Pastor Billy Crone does a wonderful job. He has a lot of wonderful footage there. And when you see the footage, why, of course, it just verifies what he's saying. I do not know how he puts these together, but he does a wonderful job. He's working on 6, a Final Countdown 6. And as soon as that's we have it and we've seen it, why, we'll make it available to you. But you can get these items by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Again, John Shorey's book entitled The Window of the Lord's Return. I think it's well worthwhile reading. Is he absolutely right? I can't say. But I will tell you, it's very, very provocative. And he has come up with some of the same conclusions that I have. And, of course, we've never really talked until the last few weeks. So, again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to understand why we have so much cancer and disease, and so many people certainly having so many physical problems, why, you certainly would want to get my talk on Population Control, the Covert Agenda. And then, of course, we bring it more up to date with another talk. It's called Agenda 21, the Covert Plan. That comes with a syllabus, and you'd certainly want to get that information because it gives you a lot of the documentation, not the things that I've come up with, but the things that they have actually published. So that is the Population Control Agenda. That is Population Control, the Covert Agenda, and certainly the DVD. Agenda 21, the Covert Plan. Now, if you get either one of those, just ask for a free copy of my monograph on the Population Control Agenda. It's one of the best things out there. The Population Control Agenda, if you don't want to get anything from us, go up to the internet and just type in Population Control Agenda. Population Control Agenda, Radio Liberty, or Stan Monteith, or just Population Control Agenda, pull it down and read it. And certainly, it will give you tremendous insight into what's going on and the spiritual forces, the powerful spiritual forces to kill off a large part of the population of the world. And so, till tomorrow at the same time, Monday at the same time, may the Lord be with you. As we raise our voice.
ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour Radio Show. You're in the right place. Especially if you live in Austin, Texas, to find out what the latest threat is. I kid you not. It is 29 March 2013. It is Friday. Josh is in the studio. Thank you so very much, Josh, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We missed you.
Yes.
A lot.
I missed you guys, too.
Oh, well, I want to hear that. I want to hear that. Yes. No, we are so glad to have him in the studio today, and we are going to have another favorite of the Power Hour, big-time favorite, Rick Kaler.
Ah, cool. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. He'll be joining us to let us know someone who did a really nice thing.
Good.
This is Feel Good Friday, and we decided for a change we might actually feel good on Friday instead of walking out of here going, oh, that was Thursday and a half, man. We don't like that. We want to talk feel-good things. So we're going to have Rick, because Rick always has a true story for us to hear. And I'm really pleased to have you join us today.